New South Wales teen Jessica Small and her best friend Vanessa were looking for a ride to a friend's house. A car pulled up and the two teens got in, giving their destination to the driver. As they pulled onto the road, the driver turned the car off and lunged at Jessica. A struggle ensued and both teens jumped out of the car running, screaming for help. When Vanessa reached a nearby home, she asked them for help, turning to see that both Jessica and the man were gone. For 10 years, local police essentially ignored the story, dismissing it as a runaway situation. Witnesses were ignored, evidence was destroyed without examination. It wasn't until 2007 that an investigator with a genuine concern took over and began looking into what should have been looked into years earlier. 23 years later, the images become sharper and the events that transpired that night more detailed. A suspect has been named and new information uncovered. Police have struggled with the setback of how the case was handled early on, but all these years later, there may finally be hope that Jessica's abductor will be brought to justice. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 121, The Abduction of Jessica Small. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine a truly disturbing abduction. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. The show is also available on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon available at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions directly through the website or email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. A 15-year-old is abducted and for over a decade, nothing is done about it. By the time an investigator starts digging in and pulling up the facts of the case, the only hope is that it isn't too late. This is episode 121, The Abduction of Jessica Small. It was a warm Saturday night when 15-year-old Jessica Small and her good friend Vanessa Conlon were hanging out and having a fun night in the city of Bathurst in New South Wales. Hours earlier, the two teens had walked into town together and spent some time at Amuse Me, an entertainment venue which offered arcade games, pool tables, and dancing, and as a result was often flooded with local teens on the weekend. This weekend was no different, and upon their arrival, the two young women met up with several friends. It was a fun night, the group of friends moving between Amuse Me and King's Parade Park, a small park near the Bathurst Courthouse. According to an inquest report issued in 2014, Jessica had a few alcoholic drinks during the night, and while she was reportedly feeling it, she wasn't drunk, with the report describing her as tipsy. After a while of hanging out, Jessica and Vanessa hopped into the car of a friend, Richard Dennis, who drove them to the home of Ben Clark, where the teens were looking to hang out. However, when they arrived, the two discovered that Ben wasn't home, and so Richard drove them back into town. Leaving together, Jessica and Vanessa stopped by a local food joint to try and track down their friends, but no one was there. Thinking they might have gone back to the arcade, the two returned to Amuse Me, though it had already closed for the night. Unaware of what to do, Jessica and Vanessa decided to try and head back to Ben's house. They figured on hitching a ride, which they had done a number of times in the past. According to Vanessa, as the two walked along William Street heading in the direction of King's Parade Park, a white car passed them at a slow rate of speed. Quickly after passing them, the vehicle executed a U-turn and stopped along the curb opposite them. Vanessa stated that she approached the vehicle and spoke with the driver. Having hitchhiked before, there was an alternating system, and it was her turn to arrange the ride while Jessica sat down on a small stone wall at the edge of the park. Vanessa later told investigators that when she approached the driver, he asked her if she had had fun playing video games and pool that night. Neither teen knew at the time that the driver may have been the same man who hours earlier had been watching Jessica. The driver asked the teens what they were up to and if they needed a ride. According to Vanessa, she told him they were heading to a friend's house and the driver said he could drop them off. Thinking nothing of it, the two teens entered the vehicle with Vanessa sitting in the passenger seat and Jessica getting into the back of the four-door sedan. As the car made its way towards Clark's home, both teens began to get a sense that something was off about the driver. He appeared somewhat agitated and both were eager to get to their destination. As they moved down the street, Vanessa pointed towards some lights at the end and asked the driver to drop them off there. He agreed, but instead of proceeding on, he slowed the car to a stop several hundred feet from their destination. He clicked off the headlights, turned off the engine, and removed his seatbelt. Neither teen could have imagined that only one of them would escape with their life. Jessica Beth Small was born on July 27, 1982 in Perth to parents Ricky and Stephen Small. When Jessica was a toddler, her parents separated and she moved to a Bathurst suburb with her mother. Jessica has been described as a bright young woman with big plans for the future. When asked about her daughter, Ricky told 60 Minutes, quote, "She loved kids and animals. She loved us. She was just a normal, happy, healthy young girl with a lot of dreams," end quote. Jessica loved music, was full of energy, and had a large circle of friends. In 1997, when she was 15, Jessica was living in Fish Parade, Gorman's Hill, outside of Bathurst. While she was in 10th grade at the time, she developed a close friendship with Vanessa Conlon, despite the two attending different schools. Vanessa later described Jessica as her best friend, saying the two spent almost every day together, mostly watching television and listening to music when they weren't hanging out with their friends. According to Vanessa, things were a little tense at home for Jessica, who was becoming more rebellious. As a result of these tensions, Jessica took to staying with her sister, with friends, and with other family members. She wasn't attending school at the time, and according to the notes of the inquest, in the weeks leading up to her abduction, she had been bouncing between several locations, including Sydney, Orange, and her mother's home. The report states that Jessica returned to Bathurst on Wednesday, October 22nd, and that when Vanessa ran into her, she noticed Jessica had changed up her appearance, cutting her hair short and no longer wearing makeup. Reportedly, the night before she went missing, Jessica spent the night at the home of a friend, Chris Hogan, whose father dropped her off in Bathurst during the afternoon of the 25th. Jessica's reported to have returned to her mother's home that same day, dropping off clothes and grabbing other clothes. The inquest report established a pretty firm timeline of events for that Saturday in the hours leading up to the abduction. In the late afternoon or early evening, Jessica and Vanessa walked into Bathurst, at which time they ran into Ricky. After chatting with the two for a short period, Ricky gave Jessica some money and they went on down to Amuse Me. After several hours of hanging out, moving from place to place, the two girls were offered a ride by an unidentified male driving a white four-door Holden Commodore. While everything seemed fine at first, both teens began to worry that something was wrong. In describing the moments before the attack to 60 Minutes, Vanessa explained, quote, "I remember he was driving quite slowly, and that kind of put a little bit of fear into me. I remember looking into the side mirror trying to see Jess in the back seat because I was beginning to get quite worried. He'd been looking side to side, and he reached and took his seatbelt off," end quote. According to Vanessa's testimony, the man said, "Right, come here," and began reaching into the back seat, grabbing at Jessica. Vanessa reportedly exclaimed, "I don't think so," which drew the assailant's attention. Reaching over with his right hand, the driver closed his fingers around Vanessa's throat and began choking her, pushing her head back against the seat. While Vanessa was struggling to get free, Jessica opened the back door and began getting out, which distracted the driver, who released Vanessa, reaching over the front seat to try and grab at Jessica before she could exit the vehicle. As Vanessa opened her door to run, the man grabbed a handful of her hair and she later told authorities that she had to rip the hair from her head to escape from his grip. Both teens fled the vehicle at a full run, heading toward the lights of the homes at the end of the road. Screaming loudly for help, Jessica and Vanessa could feel the assailant running after them. According to Vanessa, she knew Jessica was with her because she was screaming along with her. At some point, Vanessa no longer heard her friend screaming, but believed she was still running behind her. Reaching the house at 88 Hereford Street, Vanessa banged on the doors and windows, crying out for help. Inside was Vicky Connors, her boyfriend Nathan Lavelle, and her mother, Faye. Opening the door, they found Vanessa shaking and screaming. They described her as extremely upset and very pale. Trying to ascertain what had happened, Vanessa was speaking so fast it was hard to determine. Faye later told 60 Minutes, quote, "It was very hard to understand because all she was saying was, 'My friend, I need you to help my friend,'" end quote. But Jessica wasn't there, and neither was the car. The first two officers to arrive on the scene were Sergeant Peter McFarland and Constable Rooney, both of whom testified that she was trembling and terrified when they arrived. McFarland later stated, quote, "It took us about 5 or 6 minutes to calm her down to a point where she was reasonably coherent," end quote. Hearing the story about Jessica and the assailant, the police took Vanessa in their car and began driving around the city looking for a white four-door Commodore, but they never caught sight of it. While the two responding officers believed Vanessa's story, it would be over a decade before she would hear that from another investigator. For whatever reason, the official position of investigators was to disregard her story. In their minds, Jessica had run away from home and Vanessa had made up an elaborate story to cover for her friend. As a result of this leap in logic, not only did investigators do little to try and find Jessica, but they did quite a bit to ignore evidence and witnesses. In their initial response, police scrambled a helicopter and gathered up dog teams to do a search of an area, though they weren't able to find Jessica or the car. Planes were sent up to scan along a nearby river and a race course, though they failed to turn up anything related to Jessica either. While police were investigating the abduction, they were also investigating the possibility that Jessica had run away. An article in the Sydney Morning Herald specified that police acknowledged a family friend had passed away the day Jessica vanished, and authorities thought she might have run off due to that and maybe was too afraid to return home and face the consequences. The article also noted that investigators were frustrated by Jessica's friends, noting, quote, "They know more than they are letting on, and what is worrying is that they keep referring to Jessica in the past tense," end quote. Ricky was devastated when she received word that her daughter was missing. Vanessa went to Ricky's home that night and burst into tears trying to explain the situation. In the days that followed, Ricky struggled to deal with the overwhelming situation with The Age, a Melbourne-based paper, reporting that she spent much of her day, quote, "paralyzed by grief," end quote. When asked about her state of mind, Ricky replied, quote, "I'm only just coping. I just want to know she's all right," end quote. Sadly, while several articles of the time discussed Jessica's abduction, most of them segue into a warning about the dangers of hitchhiking, giving few details of the actual case itself. In the case of a disappearance or an abduction, the first few days are incredibly important for gathering information to track down the victim. In a lot of the cases covered here on Trace Evidence, there are few, if any, witnesses, making the investigation all the more challenging. However, that's not the case when it comes to Jessica Small. In fact, in addition to Vanessa, several witnesses came forward with information through the Bathurst police, but they seemed completely disinterested in hearing their accounts. And according to at least one witness, it seemed they'd already made up their minds that it was a runaway situation and they weren't looking to invest more time and effort. The day after Jessica went missing, police were contacted by Mal Pollard, the owner of the arcade where Jessica and Vanessa had been hanging out that night. Mr. Pollard put police in contact with an employee named William Ross, who had encountered Jessica that evening, as well as a suspicious man who seemed to take an interest in the 15-year-old. He even told police that the man had told him where he worked. According to Mr. Ross, the man approached him as though he knew him and motioned towards Jessica, stating, quote, "Who's that? She looks like she's out for a good time," end quote. While Ross had a detailed description of the man, police didn't take a statement from him at that time. In addition to Ross, police were contacted by Darren Mason, a patron of the arcade who had been present that night. Mason had also encountered the strange man and had given police details about him, including a description which closely matched the one given by Ross. However, much like in the case of Mr. Ross, investigators did not take a statement from Mason either. Mason later told the inquest that he felt the information he had given police had been simply shrugged off. As it turned out, while police had sent out helicopters, planes, and dogs to try and track Jessica, they had done nothing in terms of canvassing the area. They didn't attempt to track down or speak with anyone who had been with Jessica that night, nor did they attempt to get any information about who was in attendance at Amuse Me or King's Parade Park. Beyond that, they didn't attempt to question anyone about whether or not they'd seen someone fitting the description given by Vanessa, Ross, or Mason. There doesn't even appear to be any attempt to link Vanessa's descriptions with those of Ross and Mason. Police also ignored another witness who contacted them both the day after Jessica was abducted and the day after that. Robert Fitzpatrick lived at 34 Turrendale Road, approximately 16 kilometers or 10 miles north of the location where Vanessa and Jessica had been attacked. At approximately 1 a.m., a little less than an hour after the attack, Fitzpatrick witnessed a white four-door vehicle, which he acknowledged was definitely a Holden, either a Commodore or a Chimera, pull to a stop less than 40 meters or 130 feet from his home. According to Fitzpatrick, he heard a woman screaming from the vehicle, which he described as sounding like she was in a panic. He went on to express that he may have heard the victim yelling out for help. As he watched the vehicle, Fitzpatrick noticed a hand coming up over the driver's shoulder from the back seat. At that time, the driver knelt on his seat, reached into the back, and a struggle took place. The driver exited the vehicle, opened his trunk, and appeared to be searching for something. Fitzpatrick heard a banging sound, then watched as the driver climbed back into his car, leaning into the back seat for a moment before he drove off slowly into the darkness. Fitzpatrick later told reporters that he thought it might have been a domestic situation, and at the time, he was afraid to get involved. Fitzpatrick went down to the Bathurst Police Department to report what he had witnessed. However, rather than taking a statement, police told him to go home and they would call him later. When no one called, Fitzpatrick returned to the station, at which time he was able to speak with a detective. He expressed that police seemed disinterested in taking a statement from him, and in total, only a single paragraph was typed up in the report. Fitzpatrick was then dismissed, with police apparently having little interest in speaking with the man who may have been the last witness to see Jessica Small alive. Another witness from the night of the abduction called Bathurst Police to report a near accident. Within minutes of the attack, Colin Cole was driving when he had to slam on his brakes as a white Holden Commodore with its headlights off sped through a turn, nearly hitting his vehicle. Because of the speed of the incident, Cole wasn't able to get a look at the occupants of the vehicle, though his report would have corroborated Vanessa's story at the time. But again, police did nothing with this information and never attempted to contact Cole in regard to what he had seen that night. Then there was Diane Edmonds. She contacted Bathurst Police on October 27th, a little more than 24 hours after the abduction, to report a strange vehicle. At the time, Edmonds lived at Stratford Cottage at O'Connell, approximately 20 kilometers or 12 miles south of where the abduction had taken place. In her call, she told police that she had witnessed a vehicle driving down a dirt road that leads to a creek near her home, and that in all of her time living there, she had never seen a car turn onto that road. Despite the fact that Bathurst Police have a record of the call, no statements were taken from Edmonds at the time, and she was not contacted by police for a follow-up. According to the New Zealand Herald, There was, in fact, another witness who told police that a co-worker disposed of a white four-door Commodore within days of Jessica disappearing. And yes, you guessed it, there was no statement taken or follow-up from police at that time. All in all, it appears the Bathurst police were convinced that Jessica had run away and that the entire story from Vanessa was made up. In fact, Vanessa later told reporters that an investigator directly told her that he did not believe her story. Part of why police seem to be so invested in the runaway theory comes from a letter written by Jessica to her mother, in which she mentions going away for a while. In the inquest, though, it was explained that that letter was written and delivered prior to Jessica taking a trip to Orange, a nearby city, from which she later returned, and it was considered highly unlikely that Jessica would not only have fled at that time, but that she'd have done so with none of her possessions or money. Not to mention, if I may editorialize for a moment, if you're trying to cover up for your friend running away, as Vanessa was accused of doing, it seems like contacting the police to report an abduction is probably the last thing that you would do. Jessica's case began growing cold fast, no doubt hugely in part due to the investigators' seeming opposition to any information or evidence which would contradict their runaway theory. At the time, Ricky was under the impression that the police were working diligently to try and track down her daughter, never knowing that they had essentially dismissed the case from their minds and written it off. 8 long months would pass before a forestry worker would come upon a bizarre scene which may indeed be directly connected to Jessica's abduction. Glenn Christie Johnson was a state forest employee working in the Jenolan State Forest near the town of Oberon. The forest is approximately 60 kilometers or 37 miles south from where Diane Edmonds witnessed the car driving onto the dirt road. In June of 1998, Johnson and a co-worker were heading into an isolated area of the forest off a rarely traveled dirt path when they discovered several items which immediately caught their attention. In the brush off the path, they recovered a pair of women's underwear, an empty bottle of bleach, and a blood-soaked blanket. Authorities were notified and the items were taken in as evidence. However, if you've been paying attention during this episode, you probably have a good idea of what's going to happen here. Not only did police not examine the items at the time, they didn't attempt to examine them at all for approximately 1 year. Despite the possibility of a connection to Jessica Small, authorities didn't reach out to her family and ask them about the items or ask them to identify them. They didn't test the items for DNA, nor did they apparently test the items for any trace evidence. In fact, after what's been described as a preliminary examination in the inquest, the items were destroyed. Jessica's mother wouldn't find out about this discovery for more than a decade, and by that time, there was nothing left to be examined at all. The official inquest goes on to say, quote, "No serious investigation was conducted to determine whether they may have been linked to Jessica," end quote. Johnson had been working in that area for 30 years at the time. When he was asked by 60 Minutes, he expressed that the area in which the items were found was not one where they expected to find anything. It was extremely isolated, and this led to the belief that whoever had left the items there likely had knowledge of that particular forest, suggesting they had not been left by happenstance or by a passerby, but someone who had likely been in that forest on enough occasions to be familiar with its layout. After the destruction of this new evidence in 1998, Jessica's case came to a standstill. While the case remained open, it seemed quite apparent that no one was looking into it or following up on anything. In fact, it wouldn't be until 2007, 10 years after Jessica was abducted, that there would be anything even remotely resembling an actual investigation. Unfortunately, for the investigator who took over the case, he was confronted by a set of files which were terribly unorganized and lacking any kind of leads or information. To his credit, Detective Sergeant Peter Smith was determined to get to the bottom of things. On the 10-year anniversary of her abduction, a strike force was organized to reinvestigate the case. Detective Sergeant Smith felt, from the initial moments he went over the files, that the case had been mishandled, obviously. The first person he went to speak with was Vanessa, and for her, It was a blessing, as he was the first investigator to listen to her story and confirm that he believed it. In discussing the attack with Vanessa, Smith was able to garner new details about the vehicle being driven by the assailant. In a discussion with ABC News, Smith confirmed that the vehicle was in fact a white four-door Holden Commodore. However, he revealed new details that there was an orange blanket visible through the rear window, as well as holes in the passenger floorboard. Smith explained further, quote, "The holes were described as not big enough to put your foot through, but big enough to see the road through," end quote. After speaking with Vanessa, Smith's next move was to try and track down Robert Fitzpatrick, who had come to the Bathurst police twice in the days following Jessica's abduction to report the altercation he witnessed in the white car outside of his home. Smith was able to ascertain the full story, not just the single paragraph in the original report, which to him confirmed that they were dealing with the same vehicle and that Fitzpatrick had likely been the last witness to see Jessica alive. Fitzpatrick was re-interviewed on the record that same year, giving every detail. Smith then turned his attention to Amuse Me, the arcade, looking to track down the employee, William Ross, who had spoken with the police the day after the abduction. Ross was put on the record officially in early 2008, just months after Smith took over the case. In his interview with Ross, he was given a detailed description of the man who was leering at Jessica in the hours before her abduction. The official inquest details Ross's description, saying, quote, "The man looked about 34 years of age or maybe older and said he was working at the Oberon Timber Mill. He described the man as Australian, about 5 feet 8 inches tall, medium build with a bit of a beer belly and dark hair. He said the man was wearing jeans, joggers, and a long sleeve button shirt between a cowboy type shirt and a flannelette shirt, and that he had a set of keys hanging from his jeans on a little hook," end quote. After interviewing Ross, Smith contacted Darren Mason, whose own description of the suspect corroborated Ross's, as he described the man that night as being a male with, quote, "a big build, with dark brown, straggly, shoulder-length hair and wearing a red and black flannelette shirt and jacket," end quote. In addition to the two previous witnesses, Smith also spoke with Sarah Thornhill, a friend of Jessica's from that night, who confirmed that she had witnessed a man arriving at the arcade in a white Commodore and later saw him hanging around inside. Over the course of the next few years, Smith worked not only on tracking down and speaking to more witnesses, including Diane Edmonds and Colin Cole, who retold their stories about the car driving onto the dirt road and the near accident, but also a new witness, Kayla Brian, who was 11 at the time, but reported being approached by a creepy older man on the same night Jessica was abducted. When Smith spoke with Edmonds, he found her story so compelling that they actually conducted a reenactment to try and determine the type of car she had seen, how fast it was going, and where exactly it was heading. In the weeks following this interview, several excavations took place in that area. According to multiple news reports, investigators brought in heavy machinery, cadaver dogs, and ground-penetrating radar. While nothing was found connected to Jessica, Smith told reporters that he would not rule out future searches in that area. During his investigation, Smith discovered the information about the underwear, bleach, and blanket which had been found and subsequently destroyed. When speaking to Jessica's mother, Ricky, he asked her about the items. This was the first time she learned of their discovery in the forest. Ricky later told 60 Minutes that if she had known, quote, "I would have been in that forest scratching the dirt looking for her," end quote. Beyond gathering statements from witnesses, which spanned from 2007 to 2012, Smith also had the overwhelming task of trying to figure out the connection between the man seen by the witnesses at the arcade and the Oberon Timber Mill. In total, Smith obtained a list of 400 men who had been working at the mill around that time and began the slow and painstaking task of narrowing it down. His investigation brought him all over Australia, tracking down former employees, as well as to the United Kingdom. When all was said and done, Smith narrowed his list down to two individuals, Andrew McBride, and Craig Robertson. Imagine what could have been found if only the initial officers had actually chosen to follow up on their leads. When Smith spoke with 60 Minutes earlier this year, he specified that while both men fit the description and were employed at the mill at the time, they had other things in common. Both were thought to have been in the area at the time of the abduction. Both had possibly left the area shortly after the abduction. Both had a history of violence towards women, and both lacked the ability to provide solid alibis for their whereabouts on the night of October 25th, 1997. However, there was at least one area in which their interests diverged, and that was in the age of the women they pursued. While Robertson had a history of going after young girls, McBride had a history of targeting teenagers. Beyond that, only one of them had access to a white Commodore in 1997, and that was Andrew McBride. In 2014, the official inquest was held examining Jessica's case, during which time many of the witnesses testified about their experience. Andrew McBride was brought in for questioning, as were several of his ex-girlfriends and associates. Starting with the details, which may or may not connect him to the case, several pieces of evidence were pointed out. Firstly, at the time of the abduction, McBride was employed at the Oberon Lumber Mill. However, without notice or explanation, he left town the day after Jessica was taken. Reportedly, he left town so quickly, he forgot to turn in the keys to the apartment he was renting. Carolyn Livingston was the mother of McBride's then-girlfriend, Layla, and she told the inquiry that on Sunday, October 26, 1997, McBride and Layla suddenly moved out of their apartment and asked to borrow $200 to go to Sydney. According to the Western Advocate, she also remembered seeing McBride washing the walls in the apartment prior to leaving. Livingston couldn't remember the make or model of McBride's car at the time, though she specified that it was a white sedan, and she stated clearly that she believed McBride had been obsessed with a 15-year-old girl at the time. Layla also testified, telling the board that McBride had an infatuation with the younger woman and owned a large collection of magazines entitled Barely Legal. She went on to explain that at one time she walked in on McBride giving a back massage to a 15-year-old girl who was lying face down on the bed, topless. She described McBride as a chronic liar with a violent streak. An additional female witness told the board that she remembered McBride driving a white Commodore at the time of the abduction. Her description of the vehicle itself matched up with Vanessa's, as the witness explained, quote, "Andy's had an orange blanket covering the back seat. I don't know if the seat was ripped, but the blanket was there all the time," end quote. McBride's lawyer tried to argue that he could not have been responsible for Jessica's abduction since there were bank records which specifically placed him in Sydney, some 200 kilometers or 124 miles away, that weekend. However, that wasn't exactly accurate. While bank records do show that McBride was in Sydney on Friday, October 24th, there are no records for Saturday or Sunday which would put him in Sydney the weekend. Police specified that McBride was known to travel out to Oberon and Bathurst, working in Oberon, and that notes from Friday do not rule out the ability to travel on Saturday and Sunday. The inquest officially stated, quote, "Those bank records also indicate that Mr. McBride made constant trips between Sydney and Oberon on a regular basis. Accordingly, I cannot be satisfied with direct evidence to the contrary that he did not make another trip that weekend to Oberon or Bathurst," end quote. At the conclusion of the inquest, no charges were filed, though it was ruled that Jessica Small was deceased. The report states, quote, "Jessica Beth Small died on or after the 26th of October, 1997. Her death is suspicious, and I am satisfied that she died at the hands of a person or persons unknown," end quote. With so many years having passed, Vanessa was unable to positively identify McBride as the man who attacked her that night and drove off with Jessica. When asked about McBride, she told 60 Minutes, quote, "To sit here now and say 100% it's him, that I can't do, and that breaks my heart," end quote. On October 25th, 2018, New South Wales police announced they would be offering $1 million for information leading to the arrest of a person connected to the abduction of Jessica Small. This is only the fifth time in their history that they have offered a $1 million reward. Police are hopeful that someone will come forward with new information which will finally permit them the ability to make an arrest. In March of this year, New South Wales police announced they had arrested a man connected to two sexual assaults during their investigation into the abduction of Jessica Small. No article lists the man's name, so there's nothing to confirm that it's directly connected to Jessica. Since the announcement of the reward, there have been no new developments in Jessica's case, though investigators believe they're on the right track and are hoping that they'll be able to find what they need sooner than later. It's their belief that, at a minimum, someone must remember the white four-door Commodore with holes in the passenger side floorboard. When last seen, Jessica Beth Small was described as being a Caucasian female with shoulder-length blonde hair and blue eyes, standing 5 feet 7 inches tall. Jessica was last seen wearing white jeans, a cream-colored blouse, and brown shoes. It's been 23 years since Jessica Small was driven off by her abductor, and while they've come a long way, there's still further to go in finding the answers as to what happened to her and where she might be. For Vanessa Conlon, it comes with a lot of guilt. She can't help but feel guilty for the fact that while her friend was taken, she escaped. Rob Fitzpatrick also has his share of guilt, telling 60 Minutes that if he had known then what he knows now, he would have gone up to that car that stopped near his home and done something. He referred to it as one of the hardest things he has to live with. For Jessica's mother, Ricky, 23 years is a long time to go without answers, without seeing her daughter, without knowing what happened, and without the ability to give her a proper burial. It's her hope that she'll one day get to find her daughter and say goodbye, but as the years keep passing, it becomes more and more difficult to accept that as a viable possibility. When asked about finding her daughter, Ricky replied, quote, "I would hope I could. I think coming from a mother's heart, you always want to bring your child home, your baby home." Did you know that up to 80% of the immune system is influenced by the gut? Or that supporting the immune system through proper diet and digestive health enables pets to better fight environmental allergies? Solid Gold is passionate about gut health because a healthy digestive system positively impacts the immune system and overall wellness of pets. Solid Gold's nutritional platform is inspired by their founding belief that high-quality food is the best way to impact our pet's mind, body, and spirit. For over 45 years, Solid Gold has revolutionized the holistic pet food category, and they have a recipe for any dog or cat's dietary needs, including healthy whole grain and grain-free options, wet food, supplements like sea meal, and 100% human-grade bone broth for dogs. Solid Gold foods are different because they cleanse the digestive system with whole superfoods, balance with living probiotics, and fuel with omega-3 and 6 fatty acids, supporting gut health and nourishing your pet inside and out. Right now, to see the Solid Gold deal of the week, go to solidgoldpet.com/trace. That's solidgoldpet.com/trace to see the deal of the week. Remember, SolidGoldPet.com/trace. Taking care of yourself is extremely important, and it doesn't have to be difficult either. With CBD, you can feel better without needing to rearrange your whole life. CBD helps me feel more rested, calm, and my body feels a lot less sore, which is a grateful break of pace at this time in my life. Now, I'm not talking about that gross-tasting juice that you drink out of a weird dropper that's impossible to get an accurate dose from. I'm talking about Caliper, a better way to consume CBD. Unlike CBD oils, Caliper CBD powder is tasteless and blends easily into any food or drink without a nasty aftertaste. That's exactly 20 milligrams in each package, taking all the guesswork away. I add Caliper to my morning coffee, and it's a great way for me to start my day. With Caliper CBD powder, you're clinically proven to absorb 450% more CBD compared to tinctures. That's pretty crazy. And Caliper gives you all the benefits of CBD in just 15 minutes, about twice as fast as CBD oil. Caliper comes in both 10 and 30 count packs, and best of all, you can get started for less than $20. Caliper has a special offer for all Trace Evidence listeners. Get 20% off your first order when you use the promo code TRACE at trycaliper.com/trace. You can try Caliper CBD risk-free for 30 days. If you don't love it, they'll give you a full refund, but you're gonna love it. That's trycaliper.com/trace. Don't forget to use promo code TRACE for 20% off your first order today. The abduction of Jessica Small is a difficult case to analyze for a number of reasons. From the horror of what she must have endured to the overwhelmingly asinine way police handled her case. A 15-year-old gets abducted by a violent man, driven off into the darkness, and rather than following up, questioning witnesses, taking reports, and maybe having a chance to find her alive, her case is ignored. She's tossed aside as a runaway. Her best friend, who was also attacked, is called a liar, and for a decade, not a single thing is done to help the case. Only things like, you know, destroying evidence before it's analyzed. There's no rhyme or reason here. There's no answer that's going to explain it in a way that doesn't make you want to throw your headphones across the room. I'm certainly not going to try and justify it to you. 10 years pass before someone actually gives a damn enough to investigate, and he does a hell of a job for someone taking on an investigation in which basically nothing was done. A formal inquest is held, where it's plainly spelled out that this investigation is a textbook example of how not to operate. After all that time, Detective Sergeant Smith is able to narrow a suspect pool down to 2 men and ultimately 1 who fits the bill. However, a lack of information and evidence holds charges from being filed. Can you imagine where this case would be if the investigation had been done right from the start? More than likely, it wouldn't be on this show because it would have been solved if they actually tried. Unlike a lot of cases I cover, this one doesn't have a bunch of theories. It's an abduction. There's no possibility of a runaway situation here, despite what police thought for apparently 10 straight years before someone with a brain and integrity got involved. We know Jessica was taken. We know the man who did it would likely have taken Vanessa along with him if he'd had the chance. The only thing we don't know, beyond the shadow of a doubt, is who that man was. There's really 2 main possibilities. Either it was Andrew McBride, or it was someone police have yet to name. So let's begin first with the more vague option, the possibility that the killer is yet unknown to investigators. There's a couple of different scenarios here. According to a lot of the news articles I read, there was somewhat of an epidemic of missing teenagers in the area at the time. Hitchhiking was still happening a lot, so a lot of newspapers, when addressing Jessica's story, went out of their way to point out the dangers of hitchhiking. Some have wondered if it was possible that there could have been a serial killer operating in the area at the time, and I don't know that that can be completely dismissed. The fact of the matter is, this isn't a super sophisticated abduction. Trying to single out a particular type is challenging because it's the kind of crime that almost any sick person might try to pull off and likely has in the past and will again in the future. When you look at the way things went down that night, it isn't difficult to imagine how dangerous of a situation it was. 2 teenagers looking for a ride. A random guy pulls over, offers to take them where they want to go, and they hop in. Minutes later, just a few hundred feet from their destination, the guy strikes. Both of them are struggling to escape, and for a moment they do, running as fast as they can towards the light in a house down the road. But when Vanessa arrives, Jessica and the suspect are gone. It must have happened so quickly, it's impossible to imagine what must have been going through their heads. Based on the way I've read the account, in multiple places including the inquest, it seems to suggest that Jessica was the assailant's main target. She's in the back seat, but he turns around and goes at her first. When Vanessa and Jessica are running, she's the one he grabs and drags back to the car. Whoever the killer was, Jessica caught his eye for some reason, and we may never understand why. It's not a unique story, though. Sadly, this kind of thing happens a lot. Teenagers targeted by older assailants who see them as easy to control and overpower. How many times have they gotten in a ride in the past and nothing happened? How many people in the past week have gotten into cars with strangers for a ride? In a lot of cases, it may have worked out, but I sincerely doubt they all got away cleanly. It's somewhat bizarre to me in certain ways, though. This guy didn't try to drive them to some isolated location to assault and kill them. He drove them right near to where they asked to be dropped off and then attacked on the side of the road, not far from the very home they were trying to get to. That seems strange to me. I can't wrap my head around that. One part of me feels like it's ego. He thinks he's going to get this girl interested, or he's going to say something to make her want to stick around with him. When it doesn't go his way, then he decides he's just going to try to take what he wants. He's not worried about being caught, though. He doesn't speed off as soon as the two of them get out of the car screaming their heads off. He gets out of the car and chases them, grabbing Jessica and pulling her back. He's not worried about someone coming out of their house and getting involved. He's not worried about someone driving by. He's focused on what he wants, and partially due to luck, as twisted as that is, and a lot of poor investigation, he does get away with it. It just doesn't feel like your typical abduction. There's things about it that are just off. He knows Vanessa saw him, he knows she can ID him and his car, and he goes for it anyway. Does that sound like the kind of person who's never done this before? To me, it just doesn't. It feels like someone who is confident, someone who knows what he can do and maybe has done this before. If that's the case, maybe we are looking at a serial killer picking up teenage girls this time. It would make sense. However, looking at the only real suspect we have, there doesn't seem to be anything to suggest he'd abducted anyone in the past. At least if he did, police aren't aware of it. So after a quick break, let's take a look at Andrew McBride. Today's program is brought to you by Athletic Greens, the all-in-one daily drink to support better health and peak performance. Even with a balanced diet, it's difficult to cover all of your nutritional bases. That's where Athletic Greens will help. Their daily drink is like nutritional insurance for your body that's delivered straight to your door. Developed from a complex blend of 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, Athletic Greens is a greens powder engineered to help fill the nutritional gaps in your diet. Their daily drink improves your everyday performance by addressing the four pillars of health: energy, recovery, gut health, and immune support. I've tried a lot of different morning routines to be healthy, but they can get expensive. Taking a bunch of pills and vitamins every morning isn't the exciting start to my day that I was hoping for. I've tried other greens powders before, but they tasted horrible. Athletic Greens actually taste good, and it makes it easy for me to get the vitamins and minerals I need in just one drink. My mornings start out better, with more consistency and a delicious taste that gives me the energy and focus I need to approach the rest of my day. I love that it's so easy, just a simple shake, and it has completely upgraded my vitamin regimen. Whether you're looking to boost your energy levels, support your immune system, or address gut health, now's the perfect time to try Athletic Greens for yourself. Simply visit athleticgreens.com/trace to claim our special offer of 20 free daily travel packs with your first purchase, a $79 value. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/trace. The official inquest did a fantastic job of establishing McBride's troubled history. We have one witness reporting that he had a violent temper and a disturbing attraction to teenage girls. One ex-girlfriend described him as being obsessed with a 15-year-old, someone who she walked in on him massaging topless, someone who he was manipulating and trying to control. According to 60 Minutes, in 1997, the same year Jessica was abducted, McBride was making advances on a 15-year-old girl who he later slept with when she turned 16, which was legal at the time. He was 37. It's quite clear from the get-go that McBride, if the allegations are true, has serious issues which would make him a very good fit for the person who could have been leering at Jessica that night, the same person who later abducted her. So what actual evidence exists? Well, there's the car. Multiple people put McBride behind the wheel of a white Commodore back in 1997. Smith told 60 Minutes that the Commodore that McBride drove had holes in the passenger floorboard, the same holes that Vanessa described in detail. Vanessa also mentioned an orange blanket, one which a witness at the inquest claimed was always in the back seat of McBride's Commodore. So you have a guy with a sick attraction to teenagers driving the same car that was described by not only Vanessa, but multiple witnesses in the area that night, and of course that orange blanket. McBride worked at the Oberon Timber Mill, the same place that William Ross says the man stalking Jessica claimed to have worked the night of the abduction. Another witness puts a white Commodore at the arcade that night, and the description of Ross and Darren Mason fit against pictures of McBride from this time period. The day after Jessica was abducted, McBride flees the area, moving to Sydney with no notice or explanation for his apartment or his job. His girlfriend's mother reports seeing him cleaning walls in the apartment before he goes. McBride claims he has an alibi. Bank statements show he was in Sydney the weekend that the abduction took place, but those bank records don't actually show that. What they show is that he deposited money into his account that Friday, but they show nothing about his whereabouts over the weekend. Even in the official inquest, they noted that he was unable to provide them with evidence which would show he couldn't have been the man responsible. So when you put it all together, you've got a guy who has a disturbing attraction to teenage girls, who's driving the same type of car as is used in the abduction, who was witnessed by at least two individuals at the arcade that night. He flees the area the day after the crime, and he can't provide a solid alibi for where he was. Multiple people from his past depict him as violent, misogynistic, and sexually attracted to underage girls. It feels like a slam dunk, and yet he's never been charged. According to Smith, they simply don't have enough evidence to actually link him to the abduction. The car isn't around anymore. They can't check it. No witnesses after all these years can identify him as the man they saw that night with 100% certainty. So, we come to a stalemate of sorts. There's no physical evidence. Perhaps had the police actually tested or not just haphazardly destroyed the blanket, bleach, and underwear, they might have been able to gather DNA evidence or something which could conclusively link McBride to Jessica. Unfortunately, things were handled so damn poorly that it's simply not an option today. Police believe there could be a link between the sighting of Diane Edmonds, where she saw a car drive into the dirt road near the river, but all searches of that location have turned up empty. What's interesting is that the specific location where she lived, on O'Connell near the Fish River, is a 20-minute drive north of Oberon, the town where McBride was living. Well, up until the day of Jessica's abduction, when he suddenly felt the need to move away very quickly. I should also note, the forest where the underwear, bleach, and blanket were found is just a 40-minute drive south from the Fish River, just 20 minutes south of Oberon. Johnson did say he thought whoever had left those items there would be familiar with the area. Everything seems to line up so perfectly. You can only imagine the frustration for investigators like Smith, people who actually worked hard to try and break this case. The timeline, location, sightings, descriptions, vehicle, everything matches up, and yet you still don't have enough to file charges. McBride denies knowing anything about the case or Jessica. When 60 Minutes confronted him out on the street, he talked very casually about it and expressed that he didn't know anything about the case until the police questioned him. I can't begin to imagine what it must feel like to think you've got the killer in your grasp, but you can't fully close your fist around him. It seems quite clear that investigators have their sights locked on McBride, and obviously for good reason. It becomes a matter now of finding that piece of evidence to make everything fit together, whatever that evidence might be. I don't think we're looking at a situation where there's going to be a confession. McBride seems pretty comfortable just outright dismissing the accusations altogether and claiming total innocence. I honestly don't know what it's going to take for police to be able to get their break. But finding that white four-door Commodore with holes in the passenger floorboard would be a good start. The problem is, No one has seen that car for more than 20 years. It's a tough case. It's a heartbreaking case, and it's made all the more so due to how poorly things were handled in the beginning. In a lot of cases, investigators miss something or screw something up. That's bound to happen. However, here we have an example of a killer getting away with his crime for over 20 years, and a lot of that is due to the negligence on the part of the original investigators. Who knows what else the killer might have done, how many other victims there might be, all because it was easier to believe Jessica ran away. How much misery and pain must her family and friends have felt knowing that the man who did this to her is still out there somewhere? It's been 23 years. Jessica Small was born 4 months before I was. She'd be turning 38 years old in less than a week. Who knows what she might have done with her life, how many of her big dreams she might have seen come to fruition. Instead, she's driven off into the night, and more than two decades later, there's no telling what might have happened to her or where she might be. Her family has painfully accepted that she's likely dead. Police believe she was likely murdered the night she was taken. Unfortunately, without something new, something important to break the case, the truth may never come to light. For now, there's $1 million waiting for the person who comes forward with information, and if there's one thing the police are sure of, it's that someone out there knows exactly who is responsible for the abduction and likely the murder of Jessica Small. All it takes is one phone call to alleviate the pain of a grieving family, put a sick killer behind bars for the rest of his life, and to get rich. If you're looking for more information about the abduction of Jessica Small, there are some news articles available out there. The official inquest report is available for reading, and the Australian version of 60 Minutes did a fantastic job doing an episode on this case. If you have any information about the abduction of Jessica Small, please contact the New South Wales Police Department at 1-800-725-631. You can also contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-333-000. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. I'd like to take a moment now to thank our amazing Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne M. Bertram, Astrid Maria Nyer, Brett Eady, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Jessica Chagnon, Kevin Bonham, Megan Cotter, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah, Samantha Ford, Stephanie Eve, Stephen Weiland, Tara Doble, Tom Archer, Tracy Woods, and Travis Skepsko. You're all amazing and your contributions are greatly appreciated, as are all patrons. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or visit trace-evidence.com for further information. I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.